Oh, hi, friends.
Hi.
Good to see everybody, but Paul decided to show up.
Exactly. God. So late. So late.
Oh, so late. At a time, just for those not on the podcast, we decided to join at 4:21 when we said we'd meet at 4:30. But really, isn't it
so
just
brutal.
Like Paul to not read our minds and not show up?
Know, right? So brutal.
Well, I mean, normally he pings me like 15, 20 minutes before we get on, be like, why haven't you started the Zoom yet, JJ? And I
just
did,
hanging out, waiting.
Yeah, JJ, I actually think he pings you 20 minutes after we were supposed to start recording. And he's like, JJ, where the fuck are you? Because he's usually yelling at me on another thread. Like, this guy.
Oh, that's good stuff. Well, I want to say I did actually listen to the podcast last week. And
did you?
I did. And I got those sweet listener metrics of at least one person listening, which was always good. Thank you for not throwing me under the bus all the time. I appreciate that.
I tried to absorb some of it, but it just always...
I was going to say, like, did you do your homework, though? That's the question.
That is the question.
Oh, shit.
Oh, shit. Yeah. He said he listened. He made sure the podcast loaded and then he blacked out watching,
right,
thinking of Fast and Furious quotes the whole time.
It's true. But by the way, goodness. That's coming out on in demand or on demand, I believe this next week. So
there we go.
There we go.
Now we know.
Cool. I still feel like I have to get over myself and
so
watch
excited.
It.
So excited.
I feel like, so my wife absolutely loves movies, and one of the things she's missed the most in the last year and some change is going to the movie theater. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. I do feel like it would be a kindness for me to have a faux movie theater night, to like really set up the basement for it, have the popcorn popped, and just,
nice,
you know, let Fast and Furious really be that romantic flick that just brings us together.
So romantic. It's like, yeah, the best one.
It really is.
I hope you really hear the sarcasm dripping.
What sarcasm? That,
sarcasm all the time.
Oh, Paul's here all of
yeah,
a sudden.
Hello.
What the hell?
Just a few minutes late.
You're all 6 minutes early.
Or are you late?
Exactly. What is that saying? If you show up on time, you're late. If you show up 15 minutes early, you're on time.
You're on time. Yep.
Yeah. That's what serial killers say.
That's exactly what serial killers say.
I'm glad we're on the same page there, Paul. I will never tell you that.
I mean, I was about to say my dad used to say that, but...
I hope he's doing okay,
dear,
in jail.
Yeah, he is. He's fine. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, fun times. Well, welcome, Paul, to the podcast.
Hi.
We're
Thanks
happy you're
me.
Here. Yay. All right. Who's going to start?
Well,
the actual serious things.
Yeah, I actually have one that I wanted to bring up, and I even put it on the board. Yeah,
I know. I saw JJ Asgar on our GitHub board, and I'm like, he missed one episode, and he's a new man. I think you need to skip a show now and again just to, you know, get that skip back in your step.
There you go.
Please, JJ, don't stop on my accord. Like, what's going
on? So I'm going to just jump directly into the nerd stuff because I really want to have this conversation with people who actually know these, like this world. And it turns out Kubernetes is moving to 3 releases a year. It's been officially accepted. And I think that's bad.
Why?
Well, hold on. Is there anyone here that's on the same side as me? Or are we all like, no, we should absolutely do, you know, 3 releases a year?
I don't have enough context to understand what you're saying is bad. Like moving from 4 to 3 releases, what's the...
Or are you saying like, what's the alternative, I guess, you're pitting this against? Like having a release every day or having a release once every 2 years?
Like... Yes, exactly. Like, right now it's their quarter releases of not major, but minor. So not X, Y releases quarterly. And then Z when needs done, right? If X, Y, Z is the summer. And they're moving from quarterly to 3 times a year for Y releases, which for me, I think that's bad. I think that's a really bad idea. And I was hoping that someone else was going to back me up here. Otherwise, I'm just going to go on a rant about why I think this is wrong.
Before we stomp all over you. Yeah, I mean, go for it, Laura.
I was going to say, so this was actually part of the Kubernetes community meeting like 3 or 4 meetings ago. We actually had everybody on and we talked about it as a group.
No, no, but I mean, that's so thoughtful and going to be detailed. But like, first, let's not stop a train when it's going to go off.
Okay,
cliff.
Yeah. Go for it.
What's your take?
I didn't actually know about the meeting because
No, it's cool. Yeah. That's the whole point. Rant away, man. What are you feeling?
Okay, so right now, the challenge with Kubernetes is that it makes the Y releases quarterly, which allows it for smaller iterations. The theory being smaller iterations because it's iterations on it, where you don't make major like waterfall of releases, right? Moving cool. to 3 releases a year means there's going to be larger changes, which in turn, with something already complex as Kubernetes as it is, waterfall, getting closer to waterfall releases, even if it is just one step back, is scary, especially if you're trying to make money off this. I know for a fact from the OpenStack community and how we used to do the cycles we did there, that's only every 6 months, right? 2 releases a year. And it was ripping out things left and right, where if you were just 2 releases behind, you were on the Stone Age compared to what it was released today. So for me, I'm really scared about this.
Cool. So to make sure I'm following, like to consolidate the argument, you're saying any step away from faster or smaller releases is potentially risky to the consumers, what you're saying are end users, as well as companies that are trying to make money on the consumption of Kubernetes.
Exactly.
Cool. Okay. So I just want to make sure I heard. Go for it.
So ask a quick question about that, JJ. OpenStack. 2 releases a year. How well did end users keep up with OpenStack at 2 releases a year?
I ran trunk in my house all the time.
How much did you pay for OpenStack?
Yeah, right.
Exactly. JJ, Oscar.
Yeah. In all seriousness, you're right. The underpinning of that statement Paul just made is that you're right. Nobody kept up with it, right? Like very few were able to, minus a couple companies who decided to spend an exorbitant amount of money on engineering resources or free software to make that work. And I saw from at least the position I was at Chef with that work, I saw ridiculous amounts of wasted energy, wasted effort for something that did not pay off for that company. And for me, I'm scared that this is a step moving back is to 3 releases is moving towards that ecosystem where I would have preferred, like, let's do monthly releases of Kubernetes. Let's like do the CentOS stream kind of idea.
So here's,
like, that seems more reasonable.
Here's what you're missing though. The issue is not the size of the release, it's the release.
Okay.
Right? From an end user enterprise perspective, it's changing from one version to another, regardless of the size. That is the issue. So whether you have 4 releases a year or 2 releases a year, you're still going to be 2 years behind.
So you're telling me it's this whole story of I cannot get the new piece. I have policies inside of my company as a downstream consumer where I cannot ever be running the newest. I have to be doing proven. Like there's, I know companies have that. Where
It's totally a stability versus speed like concern, right? And that's not going away. Like this is, we're asking people to run this as the underpinnings of their entire infrastructure. And therefore, stability will win over features. Full stop. Right?
So, yeah, Laura, do you want to bring in the community angle of how we got here?
Yeah, so I do kind of want to give the clarification with the statement that I'm not part of SIG release. So, like, I'm going to get something wrong. So yell at me on Twitter. But basically, I know, it's okay. Basically, one of the things that comes up is that as the community keeps getting larger, like more and more people are using it, more and more people are trying to get all of this done. The amount of people who are actually working on releases is still very small. Like you get a lot of drive-by contributors. That's a really common thing, but you don't get people who are just consistently working on it for like a good amount of time over time. So trying to get releases out very, very quickly is getting harder and harder as the system gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and this ecosystem is getting larger. So this allows people to ensure that they're taking care of their mental health, that we actually get good features out, that we're not turning around and saying, oh no, we need to take that out. And then the end user is just constantly seeing change, 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 change that they can't keep up with. They don't necessarily have the context for. But from the community standpoint, this way we can make sure the tooling is solid behind the releases to make sure that we actually can release on a good cadence, that all the testing is all working properly, those sorts of things. And, you know, it also means that the features that are getting added have more time to mature, more time for people to test it. Because one of the things that's happened over the past year and a half is a lot of people have lost their time to actually contribute, because it feels like we're all just constantly in a time crunch. So because of that, you find out about the changes like a month later, and you're like, oh wait, I didn't get a chance to test that feature that was part of my job to help out in the community, was testing that feature or using that feature. So as we start seeing more special interest groups or SIGs, for people who don't know what I mean by SIG, I apologize, and more working groups working on different components and doing different things, the communication structure is a lot harder to maintain. And so trying to make sure like one group is aware of a change that may affect their stuff is one of the big things we're trying to solve in the Kubernetes community overall. So that's the like the community angle from the, how do we actually make this work? Because in the end, like OpenStack to me was a lot more corporate driven, even if it was open source. There were a lot of companies working on it like full time. They had dedicated people working on OpenStack. Kubernetes is like this weird hybrid. There's a lot of people working on it from all over the place, but no one's, I shouldn't say no one. There are some people who are dedicated to it, but there's not as many. It's a lot more scattershot. And so it's a lot harder to maintain a cadence. And by having a set one like this means that there's a lot more work that can be put into it. Does that make sense?
It does. But my question to you then is, if we're going to three releases, why don't we just go to one release, right? Like if we are worried that badly that we can't get things out, like we're always in this time crunch. We don't have the communication pipelines. Like three seems like a weird number, right? Like shouldn't we jump even farther to one, where we do a yearly release of Kubernetes that all of a sudden we, I don't know, tack it to the year or whatever. And then we spend that year to let it crystallize, and then we release it the next year. And if you want to do something like more cutting edge, if you will, you do the dev branch or something like that. I don't know. But what it seems if we're really, like the concerns you said are very valid. Absolutely. But three seems like a weird line to make that choice at. No?
I think the idea behind three, because I thought it was 3-4 was the idea, 4-3 releases per year. And it's because we're trying out the new cadence. We're trying to see if it works. And 1 month is probably going to be more holiday, or if you're doing code freeze, if you're dealing with things, because let's face it, a lot of people who are using Kubernetes might actually have code freeze at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. So you don't have the opportunity to change anything. So you leave it alone. Yeah. You can't upgrade your boxes without putting in a ticket and getting an exception and doing all of the mess that goes along with that. So I think the main idea was 3-4 was a cadence that made sense, just from a, we want velocity, we don't want to do it too fast. So they kind of settled on 3-4 to see. Too furious, I know. We kind of settled on 3-4 just to see how that works. And if it works well, I don't know if there's more to that from SIG release. That would definitely be a question for some of the folks there. I don't know who I would send you to right
now. Laura, you did a fantastic job summarizing like the really detailed blog post that Celeste and Adolfo and James and Jeremy, like the people that have been at the core of this decision making and the Kubernetes enhancement proposal that brought this to a conclusion. But I mean, JJ, you made a good point that like going to bigger releases does mean like there's a bigger delta, and in a space that's changing even faster, that means even bigger delta between releases, which is harder to test and more to do. So that's right. And what Laura said is absolutely true. There aren't like dedicated, like no company wants to pay to help an upstream project release the project when they are consuming the raw bits to make their own branded version of it. It's a zero thanks role after some point, especially when you need to pay very highly skilled engineers to do it. So there's that angle of it, of community is eating up this cost and it is emotionally costly. The analogy to OpenStack is the only thing that I feel like is easy to poke at because it's just such a different development model. Like there is only one Kubernetes, unlike OpenStack, where you could pay to play and make your own. And then it went from, that was my understanding about OpenStack.
I'm not sure what you mean there. I mean, you had to be OpenStack to call yourself OpenStack.
I thought you had to be a member of the OpenStack committee, and then you had like your officially branded OpenStack that then possibly went downstream and merged into the main one. Okay, I got that totally wrong. So tell me how OpenStack worked to see if I got that right.
I mean, it was pretty similar, right? I mean, if you wanted to have an OpenStack product and call it OpenStack, you needed to meet the guidelines around like proving that it's OpenStack, which was all about interoperability. Like an OpenStack cluster must do these 100 things. If you run these 100 things and they all work, you can call yourself OpenStack.
Okay, so like PRD development style. But like what about new feature development? How did a new feature get into the let's say, upstream OpenStack from all those implementations?
Well, say you're doing stuff in Neutron, you create pull requests. In this case, it goes through Garrett, but whatever,
yeah,
same thing.
Whatever, same thing, yeah.
And it gets approved by the upstream. It gets brought in, and that's it.
Hmm. I think... To me, what the biggest difference is from OpenStack to Kubernetes, and maybe this is just kind of how I think of things, if you wanted to run OpenStack, you had to have a lot of stuff. You had to have a lot of infrastructure ready to go. You had to like kind of run your own servers, do your own thing, be ready to really build stuff with it. So it was much more the realm of corporations. People consumed it, but if you were going to run it, you mostly were running it as a corporation. So a rack space running it on the servers that they have and the various load balancers, et cetera. Whereas Kubernetes, like you can run that on a Raspberry Pi. You can run that on your local system. So to me, it's a much wider group of people. And therefore, like anybody can contribute to it because you don't need all of the various pieces of infrastructure to actually build on it. So I look at it as it's a much more democratic group in the sense that it's not big corporations kind of being part of a foundation that's building it. It's people coming in and doing different things and trying to help. And I know, I mean, like,
which engineers started this, like big corporations.
I know, but what I'm saying is at this point, yes, you do still see the corporations being part of it, but you also see just people showing up and being part of it, which I don't really think we really saw with OpenStack because you needed so much stuff underneath you to be able to even.
I feel like we did see that with OpenStack because you could run OpenStack on a VM. You could run OpenStack on
Raspberry Pis. That's
true. At this point, I don't see any major like size or infrastructure differences between Kubernetes and OpenStack. Certainly, at like I'm developing it perspective.
Yeah, my understanding of the difference was like how the control occurred around who got, you know, blessed as an implementation and how did features get brought into it. Like the CNCF.
Let's talk about the big tent.
The CNCF is a big tent. It's like, tell me what's different about the CNCF and the big tent.
Sure. The CNCF is a marketing arm supporting the neutral development of software, but the engineering of that software goes through corporations that have some demonstrative claim in the technology. And because of Google being the parental figure of Kubernetes, they have the largest say in its infrastructure to date. Red Hat being close behind, especially with IBM investing in it too. VMware showing up regularly being a big part of it too. But the CNCF doesn't demand, and they demand some compliance on how open source it is and how decisions are made and governance and own the marketing. But the engineering is really going through a very different mechanism. Like the CNCF like does not do the day-to-day engineering work.
Neither does Kubernetes. The OpenStack Foundation of OpenStack.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know how OpenStack worked. I just watched it fall apart from afar.
Yeah, like, I mean, there's a lot the same and there's a lot that different, but I feel like the overall way to contribute is pretty similar. And they're both powered by for-profit foundations that enjoy taking money from corporations and then not necessarily turning that into putting it back into the community. For example, we're talking about the community, the release SIG and individuals, people's like mental health and burnout and stuff. So there's two people making money in Kubernetes, vendors and the CNCF.
And
as an extension, the Linux Foundation. Well, yeah, but we're
part of
as individuals, we're getting paid for it, but we're not making money, right? If you know
what I mean. We're not the ones selling.
We're not collecting revenue from it.
Yeah, no, I didn't get a revenue check for my PRs into Kubernetes land.
That'd be sweet. As a vendor, I'm paying money into the CNCF. To really realistically be a vendor. I know I don't have to, but let's face it, I am. Because you don't have to, but also you kind of have to.
Like bronze right? level
and
member.
So I want to pay my people to work on my distribution of it. So I want them to focus on my release. Why isn't the CNCF taking the money I'm paying them and turning some of that into what builds the releases for Kubernetes? And why is everyone who was making money on it allowed to wash their hands and kind of effectively put it on individuals? It's the same. I wonder if it's analogous to plastic bags. Why is it on me as a consumer to stop using plastic bags? Why is it on me as a consumer to stop using plastic Coke bottles?
To pay for recycling.
Why isn't it on Coke to stop making them or to give them the actual cost instead of deferring that cost to me as a consumer and also as a resident of this quickly being destroyed world? So I feel like there's some deferred costs that are being deferred to the end users that should not be getting deferred. Well, not sorry, the end users, the community and the developers that should not be pushed on to the community and the developers.
You know, it kind of makes me think about how some companies get the how to be a good community member and some companies don't. I don't know if that kind of is part of where you're going, Paul, but like that's kind of what I start thinking about is that is being a good community member, like a good open source corporate citizen, I guess you could say, providing time to your developers or is it providing money into the community or is it both or is it something more? Like, because basically we do have the groups that pay to play, the groups who pay into the CNCF to be a silver member, a bronze member. They're not necessarily contributing. I can tell you that right now. Some of them are. Some of them are sending their engineers to be part of it. Some of them are making sure some of them have time to work on the open source project. Others aren't because they don't have that kind of engineering staff right now, but they still pay in.
Right. So I don't know. Here's a question for you. Is the CNCF a good member of the community by those standards?
It's a good question. I mean, in some of the meetings that I'm part of, so I'm part of the contributor experience SIG for all clarification. We do have people from the CNCF come, and they are running the events that try to help get people to meet other contributors. For example, like the big contributor summit that's coming up, they're kind of trying to get everything organized with that, and they're helping us get there. They're paying for the venue, etc. They're also, we're looking to do a big move to get off of free Google Groups to managed email systems and managed calendars and things like that. The CNCF is going to be paying for that, I think. So there is some of that, but is it a good corporate citizen? I don't know. That's a great question. Are they dealing with more of the legal side? Maybe. Maybe it's the legal side that they're taking care of that contributors no longer have to worry about.
Yeah, they're taking on a lot of risk for so the community can function. At what point do you call it good versus bad? It's like, these are massive open source projects, and same like massive corporations are not charities. So they don't run for free. So they do have to chase down money. The question is, are they chasing down more money than they're giving back in? I don't have the data to feel one way or the other. But I've definitely been helped by people at the CNCF as a contributor. Mm-hmm. Is it equal to the, if I were to not be in a company that didn't pay me to like Kubernetes to some degree and or to keep it relevant in my life, would I be feeling like I'm getting fairly compensated for contributing? Absolutely not. No, like it, I would, there's no way in hell I would show up to Kubernetes stuff if I wasn't in a Kubernetes industry. I love the people, but I'd much rather cook with you than talk about run times, just end of the day. So it's both. Yeah. It's like we have to show up for ourselves and for each other. And I think we do one first and the other follows. Then for some, it's the selflessness. For some, it's the financial support. It's a hot, interwoven, intersectional mess.
Yeah. So taking a step back to the original question.
One of
disc down, disc yeah, down.
Disc down. That was perfectly timed.
Sorry. Wait. So Laura, for those of you who can't see, I've been redoing my disc wall behind me. Yeah, no, you can't. I've been redoing the disc wall behind me, and not all of the discs are on there just perfect yet. And so one of them fell and startled the dog behind me. So it was perfect timing. Dropped the mic almost. But anyway.
Podcasting is a visual medium. Remember, podcasting is a visual medium, and we're really good at it.
And this is why we miss you. Last week. So, Paul, were you trying to bring us back to the release cycle?
I was trying to bring us back to the release
cycle. Bring us back. What's your thought there?
I think for folks that think that chasing features is important, like they don't even need to care about the release cycle. They can chase the features they want. Like that is available to them. Like Rackspace used to say they would follow head or trunk in OpenStack. They wouldn't care about the release cycle. And sometimes they were like right up ahead. Sometimes they were 18 months behind, but they were keeping up with the features and the things that they found important at the speed at which they could. And so that option is always there. So we don't have to follow the Kubernetes release version. So whether it's 4 or whether it's 3, I don't think it really matters. I think what's important is that Kubernetes as like whoever is involved in building the release is doing it at a sustainable cadence. And the only other point I would make is that not a lot changes in Kubernetes anymore. Like it's way more stable than it used to be. And so dropping a release isn't necessarily a bad thing because there is less overall changes. And those changes are more and more focusing on stability and bugs than it is on feature. And also, JJ, I just like to tell you, you're wrong.
Yeah, no, I figured that was the final statement on this topic, is that, of course, JJ is wrong when it comes to this.
Well,
it's always nice to be specific about what you're wrong about this time.
I think comparing release cadence to waterfall versus agile is kind of an interesting thing to be doing. Because, I mean, while you can say like you should release after every sprint and all that sort of stuff, and yes, the more frequently you release, the better your software is on the nature of it, for at least, you know, smaller subsets of software. But I think it's a bit of a false comparison by saying slower releases means waterfall.
Well, okay. So there's one other, maybe hopefully I don't open up this can of worms.
But oh, you have. If we,
yeah, I know.
You open it, I'll kick it.
Nice. if it's going to be hard to talk to people when people start recognizing that the Kubernetes releases are slower, and we're trying to tell people to go to cloud native, where you're supposed to do small iterations and release with containers and iterate quickly internally inside of Kubernetes, mm-hmm. when Kubernetes doesn't release quickly. It doesn't. Do you see that? Do you see that weird conflict right there when you start talking about it?
Yes and no. Let's hear from Laura.
Okay. Well, because we're all gesturing and we're all trying to say something at once.
It's a visual
so
medium.
Here's the, I know, but I have to describe to people who are listening so they know what's going on. So here's the thing that
for
I look
our blind
at.
Podcast listeners.
Here's the thing that I look at when I think about that. There is a huge difference between my infrastructure is constantly changing underneath me. My platform is constantly changing underneath me. And my application is constantly changing. If it were me as a developer, I want to be able to constantly change my application with a stable platform underneath. So it almost makes sense that Kubernetes is moving this way. So if I'm talking to somebody and saying, let's move to a cloud native system, they're not looking at how fast Kubernetes releases. If they are, they don't understand how it works.
That's a damn good answer, Laura. That's a damn good answer. That's a very good way to describe it. I like it.
Yeah. I think Kubernetes is quickly becoming like the answer to like what needs to be the same so that other things can be different. Mm-hmm. Like it's no longer developing at a cloud native pace. The implication, like I'm totally with you, JJ, on the implication. It means fast, agile, blah, blah, blah. Which basically just means don't throw a PRD at me and expect a 12-month review cycle for it. That's not product these days. But yeah, it's one of those things like, oddly enough, when you said that, it was analogous to me of like why I don't totally trust Google Cloud, because I don't trust Google products, because mm-hmm. they treat their products like they don't matter. Even though Reader. I've never seen them
killed by Google.
Yeah, I've never seen Google kill cloud stuff like they kill their consumer products. But there's an association there. Like there's an analogy I'm making of like what they value. And that's their bad, but it's also my bad. Like that's the simplicity of human brains. And like you're making a great argument of simplicity there of like I'm reducing this to like how am I supposed to be cloud native if you're not even going to be cloud native and you're building what's supposed to be the baseline of cloud native? So I think the best counter argument I just heard is like Laura dunking on people, which is going to be a snippet I probably use.
Sorry.
Oh, sorry for being awesome. No, that was great.
So I hunted down a quote that I heard a couple of years ago that I think answers this pretty well for you, JJ. And it's mm-hmm. from the one and only Chris Nova. And it goes, Kubernetes, the best monolithic stateful application you get to manage that claims you'll never have to manage another monolithic stateful application again.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
So nice. Mesosphere.
Yeah. It's like when you're talking.
It's a single layer, not multi-layer.
declarative versus imperative like configuration. At some point, it's imperative. Like it's almost always imperative right at the start. And you're writing these declarative languages to remove the amount of imperativeness, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yes, it does.
Cool. I like it.
Yeah.
So what else is going on?
Yeah, let's talk about literally anything else for a little.
That was probably the deepest, techiest, nerdiest thing we've done in a long time, if not ever.
I feel dirty.
Yeah. I was going to say, I still think like the nerdiest one was when I was talking about paper airplanes and beer, but maybe that was just me.
Yeah. But I mean, but, yeah.
Yeah.
My bad. So
awkward silence.
Yeah, we were just so impressed with ourselves. JJ, you recently said you were rediscovering LinkedIn.
Yes. So, believe it or not, enterprise people don't use Twitter.
Scandal.
I know, right? Like, I've been talking to who I thought was my audience this whole time on Twitter and discovered that I was completely wrong. And it turns out they're on LinkedIn. And it turns out LinkedIn is no longer just there for recruiters to send you recruiter spam. There's actually relatively good content out there. And they've spent a lot of time to make the algorithms relative to what you're looking for. And you can really start building things off of what you need to do. And I kind of wanted to bring this up to the Brain Trust here, because I'm curious to see, have you discovered LinkedIn in that same way? Is it just another social, like, do you use it? Do you have a professional persona? Do you, what is your tactics in that space?
I think we have talked a little about LinkedIn, but this is from a fresh angle. I didn't know you were going enterprise-y, and I dig it. I might be repeating myself, but like the one note I have on LinkedIn is, you know, I started a project that was focused on enterprise architects, and there was just zero chatter on that on Twitter, and Reddit had dead ends. And then I hop on LinkedIn and it's like, oh yeah, it really is a businessy, even business techy channel these days. And the conversations on there are way better than they were in the past. Like, I think they figured out threading, they figured out comments, they figured out notifications on what topics are trending that actually make sense to you. So I am with you that I use it more than I did in the past. I do find myself writing things differently, certainly differently than I would on Twitter, because it's a different medium. And I think the medium alone is not the message. Like, you got to change the message for the medium. And I do have like a little bit, just like a touch more businessy of a tone, like complete sentences, for instance.
Wait, are you saying I shouldn't just shadow my tweets directly into LinkedIn?
Yeah, Dick, but your move, Instagram buddy. Should continue Dick to move. Be linked. I think just pipe your meat right onto LinkedIn.
Well, I mean, LinkedIn is where I talk about my sausage links, right?
Exactly. But yeah, how about others?
Well, I have a question for you, Broberg, and maybe this kind of help. How about everyone else?
All the other two giggle.
Yeah, exactly. Do you actually accept any connection from anyone, or do you have a filter? Like, I know I've started finding people that I had people in my like invite list that I don't remember at all who they are. So I came up with a rule. I've had to do something with you and recognize your name as a human, not, you know, rando person that said, I saw your presentation, I want to talk to you kind of thing. What is your qualifications?
Yeah, I'm a heavy ignorer. Like, if I think about it, like, I know LinkedIn gives more information about people I'm connected to if I'm connected to you as well. And I want to honor that relationship in the same way I would if we were in person, where I'm not going to handshake somebody into a conversation with you that you've never met, especially if they're connected to me. Like, it is that social network angle. So I protect that. And I already was like an aggressive friender of people on there from a while ago. So like, I already have a huge network. I just keep it to people I know on purpose at this point.
So you're telling me I can finally get your phone number if we friend on LinkedIn?
Absolutely not.
Hey, well, guess what?
What, Paul?
We have 13 ICU beds left in the greater Austin area.
Oh, nutsack. I was really hoping it was going to be a LinkedIn thing that you were doing. Yeah. But no, that sucks. What's
That was a bad link of conversation.
No.
You're going to pun after you hit hospital jokes?
Oh, man. Oh, dear.
You know, so, you missed me.
Now we only have 12 beds in intensive care. Left.
Goodness.
Oh, man. So, wait, how bad are things by you?
I mean, you know, it's, I mean, we're back to, I mean, we don't have a mask mandate because, you know, I have freedoms, goddammit. But
because Texas,
you know, you saw that. I mean, the CDC guidelines are back to like, oh yeah, everyone just mask all the time.
That's not true, totally. It's saying in places that are high or nearing high, but which is pretty much 90% of the company, the country.
We're in,
we're
in the high end.
No,
we're in the high end of stage four. I think Wilco is in stage five. They shot from three straight to five.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Overachievers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fucking Round Rock.
And, you know, it's all like, I think what they're starting to discover is vaccinations don't stop you from getting infected. They stop you from like getting really sick because they fight those infections before they really set in. But what's happening is people that are in that have been vaccinated, that are getting exposed to Delta, are getting enough of an infection to carry a viral load, even if it's not enough to have symptoms. And so basically my understanding is people that have been vaccinated are turning into just asymptomatic Delta carriers.
So petri dishes.
And so what that means is we're all potentially running around giving it to each other, which is mostly okay if we're all vaccinated, except not everyone is vaccinated. And some of that is by choice, some is not. So, you know, I think the people that are not doing that are doing it not by choice, but because they have legitimate medical reasons, are generally taking extra precautions anyway. So I hope this isn't adversely affecting them. The people that aren't vaccinated by choice, I could give a fuck about you. Go to hospital and die. I don't care at this point because you're literally in a murder-suicide cult. But what's happening is every time we get an infection, don't really get all that sick and pass it on, we're given that opportunity to mutate and mutate to another variant. And that is how we'll get stuff that will actually start breaking through the vaccines. And that is how we're going to go in, we're going to switch from pandemic to endemic, and we're going to end up like the flu, where 30 to 50,000 people a year are going to die from this. And that is all on the heads of the people that are refusing to get vaccinated, at least in the US, where vaccination is readily available. And I appreciate that not everywhere is like the US. Not everywhere has readily available vaccines. Haiti only just got their first loads of vaccine this week or last week. As an example. So you can't really blame people in Haiti for not being vaccinated, but there is zero excuse for Americans in good health to not be vaccinated.
But wait, hold on, Paul. I've heard people who have the COVID and they go to the hospital and they're in the ICU and they ask for the vaccine. They can't get it. Why?
I mean, I'm assuming you're being sarcastic, JJ.
Yes, I am.
But
yes,
I'm trying to make sure we're very, very clear here, because, yeah, you can't really get it if you already have the virus because it's too late. That's the point when it, you know, in case you don't know, vaccines work because you get a weakened form of the virus or the genetic code and something like that that teaches your immune system what to look for. So it doesn't exactly work differently. I don't know. I've been thinking a lot about the conversation we had last week about talking about how the variants that are, and I hate using this term, less lethal, because it sounds stupid. It's like horrible English, because you can't be less dead. Just saying. But
lethal isn't. Yeah,
it means it kills you. Yeah, I know. Well, the variants that are less likely to kill you are the ones that spread better. Because this was the conversation, Matt, that you were bringing up last week, that I've been thinking a lot about that and just kind of how this shifts and how this changes and those sorts of things. But there was a newsletter from I get The Guardian as one of the things that I get in. And
okay, big spender.
What? No, like the, you know, you donate a little bit of money, they'll send you like an email newsletter. Anyway, whatever. Y'all are kind of looking at me like I'm insane.
But no, I thought you got like a British newspaper sent to you on the daily. No, I was like, no. Oh, wow.
I only get the News of the World so I can keep up with where Bat Boy is at.
But the interesting thing that was coming up as part of this newsletter that I got today was it was talking about how there's actually a lot more barriers to vaccination than we think in the US. Yeah. Because people who can't afford to take a day off from the side effects, there still is that problem. There still is the question of trying to figure out. There's a huge heterogeneous population in the middle who have all in the middle of like the Republican Democrat divide. That's where they were talking about, who have a lot, all kinds of different things going on in their lives, ranging from work issues and childcare to paid time off to lack of information to genuine personal deliberations and concerns based on the medical institution's history of abuse and neglect, especially of people of color. And one of the things that stuck with me was the message of, hey, if you get vaccinated, we can go back to visiting family and getting to see grandparents and all that. There are people who, you know, they live multiple generations in a home, so it hasn't changed for them. So that message is falling flat. It doesn't mean anything to them. So I don't know, like, it kind of made me start wondering, could we do better? Could we find better ways to help people? And maybe the problem is more that people can't take off for the vaccine side effects, which is kind of a valid question.
Totally valid. I was listening to some reporting, I think it was from the New York Times. So you either will respect that or think it's fake because of the source, but in the coverage, and they did some research on like what's preventing people from getting the vaccine, and they broke it down. Oh, it's from Axios News, my favorite, and they broke it down into kind of three big pieces of what they found. It was about 25% of people were like, could be convinced and they were not interested. 25% of people that aren't getting the vaccine were in the kind of the category you're saying, where they're like, I already, it's stressful. I have like a lot to lose financially. If I do this vaccine, I'm not going to get there. And then 50% were like predominantly white male Southerners, Republican, that just don't believe there's any sane reason to get this vaccine, that it's not real. So I think for, you know, again, these are pretty big buckets, and there's a lot of things wrong and with polling in general, yeah, for statistics like that. But it is fair to say that you're absolutely right, that you're hitting a percentage of people that we should care about and we should be concerned about as decent human beings. Yeah, unfortunately, that's not my impression of it, and the best data I have saying it's not the majority of the people that are not getting vaccines. It's small minority.
I guess I'm not trying to like make anybody feel guilty about how they're thinking about people who aren't vaccinated by choice, but it's more of a, I guess I find it interesting that we hit this kind of limit in the US of how many people got vaccinated. We've kind of stagnated. And the question is, how do we fix that?
Yeah.
Well, you know, other than mandatory vaccination, which is a huge discussion that I don't want to get into, you know, that's kids. I mean, kids obviously are a big problem.
No, they really are.
They're a problem in general. But I mean, in terms of vaccination, you know, they are in a bad spot, obviously, because they can't get it and people around them aren't doing it the right thing. Yeah, I get it. I guess I'm just kind of trying to point out that I kind of wonder what we could do differently, how we could do better, and how we could make it better.
I totally agree. I hadn't thought of that multifamily aspect of it. And that makes a lot of sense. But I guess you were talking about people that have a distrust of the medical community, and for very good reasons. Mm-hmm. Like I don't lump them in with when I'm talking about people that are doing it by choice. I'm talking about like the freedom loving motherfuckers that are more interested in, you know, following Trump's gospel than to, exactly. They're the ones I'm talking about. But one thing you did remind me of, I saw an ad, and I'm going to link to it here, from Lysol, basically saying the pandemic's over, everyone go out and visit each other and hug each other. And it's like a PSA they actually did with like the Ad Council and other things. So I don't know if it had any medical thing or it was just like the Ad Council and stuff all got together and said we're uniquely qualified to start doing COVID PSAs. And then the COVID PSA is effectively, it's over, let's go hug and hang out. So it was really confusing.
So far,
and it was a random ad on, it was either on TV or YouTube or something.
For our non-American listeners, which we have quite a few, by the way.
Really high.
We actually do. Lysol is a bleach company. I hear that all you got to do is drink that, right? And it gets rid of COVID.
JJ.
That was last year's science, bro.
Sorry. It's a little bit of a walk.
Please don't do that. Please. Okay. No, seriously, God, please, people listening, don't drink bleach.
Don't
do drugs, kids. Don't drink bleach.
You can do drugs, just don't drink bleach.
Tide Pods.
Do drugs, get the vaccine.
There we go. I like that ad campaign. On that note, though, I know we're coming to the end of the podcast, and I do have one quick thing to note that maybe not by the time this podcast airs, but maybe by the time you're listening, I will have started a new job. I'm earning in the beginning of August. So
are we still on embargo?
Or no, we're not on embargo. I'm just not telling anybody where I'm going until the day of. So y'all
That's
can.
That's embargo.
Okay, fine. Well, no, the embargo was leaving the old company. The embargo was leaving the old company that I'm actually changing jobs. Sorry. I should have written that better in the notes, but whatever.
Oh,
But yeah, y'all. So.
Well, congratulations.
By the time you hear this, thanks. You'll have.
Well, since they're not going to hear it until it's done, you can just tell us right now.
I guess I could. Why not?
Wait, hold on. We're going to release it on the Friday. So you don't start till the first,
so you're not starting till Monday.
But that means listeners get the exclusive.
Ooh, exclusive. Ooh, okay. We can say that in the announcements,
exclusive,
right?
Update. Like, see.
So I will be a developer advocate at Pulumi. So
Pulumi.
Where all the cool kids are going.
Ta-da! So it'll kind of be a lot of fun. So I just had to say it on the podcast because I just want to be like, look, I'm doing it. I'm going. It'll
congratulations.
Be
I think we're all a little bit jealous of the co-workers you're about to inherit.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. If I was feeling startup-y, I would have been there 2 years ago. They're wonderful.
Yeah, they're very cool people. So
When you're a proper big time thought leader, are you still going to have time for us?
Yes, of course. I don't know. I'm not really one of those people I'm not really one of those people that's like a big global stage kind of person. I'm much more of an in-person person. So I will always have time for y'all.
Yeah. And little podcasts with little followings. Yes.
Hey, come on. I like this one.
Oh, no, I'm saying that sincerely.
Thank you very much.
International following. That's right. That's right.
That's why I show up. That's cool. Well, congratulations, Laura. We're really
it's not a little podcast. The water was cold, okay?
On that note, all right, everybody, say bye.
Bye.